Before I ask the first question, I want a show of hands. How many of us would have been surprised by this early turn, just like the pilot? That is, you would not have been expecting, in these conditions, the GPS to be counting down as soon as you rolled out the wings here, because that's the rub. You're sort of bitten by the fly-by waypoint rules. Tom and I are the only two people at the table who just weren't clued in to this thing. Thanks, Tom. You make me feel better.
I appreciate it.
So most people would have been figured this out. So I'll go to you, Mark. You would have expected this to happen, not been caught by surprise. Is there anything you would have done differently than this pilot while you were on the ground and had time to set this up beforehand, whether it was setting up OBS mode beforehand from the ground or anything to make your life easier so it didn't all happen on the fly, literally?
Well, I think obviously this pilot did not anticipate that.
Right.
But if, you know, if I had done my briefing, my departure briefing, and looked at it and said there's a big turn coming up, well, I need to cross that VOR, I would have simply set up OBS mode right at the beginning and just gotten it ready to go.
And that simply, so like, and would you have, you know, thrown the radial maybe a little bit offset on the airport, because in the resources here, we're getting this countdown with the leg from the airport to the VOR. We're even closer in reality because of the right turnout to the leg. Would you have taken a guess at about where you might have rolled out and
I would have taken a guess that we're heading, you know, east northeast, and it's going to be around there, and then just be able to tweak it once I make the turn.
Once you make the turn. Bruce, you're also choosing four. You're switching to OBS mode, but you're saying you're not really happy about that as an option. There's something that's even better, in your opinion. What's that?
In my opinion, it's using my number two nav that I've got down there, just setting it up to the VOR and selecting the green needle or a bearing pointer if I'm in a TA, like Mark said in his, and just flying that for that short leg to the VOR and then switching back to the, because the OBS mode, that gets people in trouble, especially with this quick a switch. So I would have just said, hey, look, I understand what, I'm looking at the picture, I've loaded this procedure, wow, that's a big turn. I'm very close to the VOR, I'm gonna use my number two, set that up on my number two CDI. And again, as the response explains, there's a lot of room to maneuver. So all this business about I'm going to blow past the VOR, I'm in a TBM or a TB21. I'm not going that far. And I'm well within all the protected airspace for this. And I don't really know how much, you know, whether the controllers are going to bark at me if I turn short. But at least I'm, again, this is a VOR-based procedure. I should fly it as such, using the GPS to help me avoid confusion.
You're keeping it simple, Bruce, by not, you know, messing with the OBS mode. Elaine, you're keeping it even more simple with just like, you know, this is going to happen quickly. You're just using the moving map. Can you expand on that for me?
Sure. I think being surprised and saying, oh, I got to quick do OBS mode and set this up, that there's just not enough time if you get caught with this. So I'm going to skip that. I'm going to fly the airplane. I'm going to use the Paradise VOR as kind of a GPS fix rather than a nav aid, because ATC, or I'll take that back, because flight planning does allow for that. However, this is a gray area where we're not sure how ATC was going to be treating this in the real world, as a fix or as a VOR that you're going to have to overfly and overshoot and then turn back. So I would put a note on three and say, I'm going to pass the VOR, but not by much, because that is a very predictable place to be. I'm going to actually fly over the fix, but then make a little bit of a turn so that I'm not overshooting it by a lot. And I'm also going to slow way the hell down as soon as I can. I know we're just out on a climb out. Slow down because of that tailwind so that that turn doesn't get to the point where you're overshooting by 4 miles and then you have to make a sharp turn, which does pose a risk when you're in a high workload situation. You're a little low, trying to make a sharp turn to make ATC happy. And we know some of the problems that can entail. So I'm going to slow down, make a turn right about there, but not quite right at it, and kind of split the difference there.
So this is kind of like a good enough sort of thing. This is all happening really quickly. You got WASP GPS, like just kind of generally over the VOR. slow things down and, yeah, I'm past it now. Now I can start my turn.
Or even just start even just right over it. Right. And based on the photos I see here, it's visual condition. You'll actually be able to see the viewer. And I've done this trick. I've done this trick in Wisconsin over the Badger viewer where they'll say, oh, when you've reached Badger, turn da-da-da heading, and then we're going to start vecting for the approach. Well, I wasn't really on OBS mode. I was using it as a fix, and I kind of picked the radial and overflow, and were visual conditions during practice approaches, so I don't think technically I was really in the wrong there. And I thought, oh, that's a good trick. You don't have to switch modes suddenly when you get surprised by something like that, so I'm going to treat it that way.
Right, no cone of confusion. I'm looking at the VOR. It's right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, on this day you can see it, so that's why I think I can pull it off that way.
No problem at all. Now, I find it really interesting that the two controllers at the table are choosing choice one. And I just want to say, before I hear from both of you as to why choice one, that the scenario pilot that this, the real events this were based on, he was in fact chewed out for doing exactly this, turning early. Both times he did it. The first time he was chewed out a little bit. And then when he did it again, ATC said, we remembered essentially from last time, really, really don't do that again. So it wasn't just a fluke or a controller who was, just kind of a little concerned or maybe didn't have enough coffee that day. This was a big deal in the eyes of ATC in this area, but you're both following the GPS turn anticipation. Let's start with Kevin.
Well, I'll start with saying that I don't know anything about this ATC facility or exactly how they run airplanes or why they might do things a certain way in this area. But I'm looking at it as, given how tight this turn is, the odds that there's another airplane that could be a conflict with me within the confines of that little triangle, I just can't see a version of things where there's a traffic conflict in there. So for me, turning in that area that I know that whole area has been protected for me, I'm not really concerned about terrain and the climb out. I'm comfortably above the terrain in that direction. It's not like we're on the south side of the airport where there's that big mountain or ridgeline or whatever it is. So I feel comfortable making that turn within that triangle that's been reserved for me.
John, what do you want to add to that?
Well, I got a slightly different take on it. So first of all, I would do option one, probably not turn quite as soon. It's counting down. We're like 3.4 miles from the VOR. You know, go heading mode and probably drive around, staying close. Maybe, you know, you kind of have to judge the turn rate, but somewhere in that 3 to 1 mile area. But the key to me in looking at this is that an ODP is a non-radar procedure. Okay, it's a VOR-based non-radar procedure. There's nothing in it that requires radar. It's designed to get an airplane from the runway to the minimum altitude or to the en route environment non-radar. And that's probably the reason why they use these the ODP. It's because it gets the airplane turning northeastbound away from the LAX traffic and everything because they can't give a heading off the ground. So they release them with the ODP, get them turning north and east, radar identify them, and then do what they got to do to get them into the traffic flow there. But the point 65 says that radial gets 4 nautical miles either side protected. So that's an 8-mile-wide protected airspace from other airplanes. So there's definitely, you know, to Kevin's point, there can't be any other airplanes in there. So who cares when you turn? And the quicker you turn, the better off you are. You know, the turn radius at 120 knots is like 0.6 miles, less than a mile to make that turn. So I could easily do it there.
Now, would it make any difference here to note that this departure procedure actually serves a bunch of airports in this area? And they all, doesn't matter where you're coming off from, kind of around Paradise there, they all send you to Paradise as kind of a collector. And then it goes off. And you're saying, so what's the difference? But clearly, ATC here actually cares, right? And enough to give a scolding at the very least.
I can't imagine why, because if you continue and you make that big wide turn, if you look at the low altitude chart, you're going to hit the Riverside localizer, Chino, all those other airports get shut down if you've got to protect that much airspace. And they would have to block all that airspace once they issue the release. So that just does, I mean, unless there's something that we're missing there, it just doesn't make sense to me why they would get upset about an early turn there.
Well, we're going to have to follow that up and try and get one of the controllers from the area to actually go on that, because I really am curious. Tom.
Yeah, I actually had a similar flight in the same area that kind of faced the same issue last fall, except I was in a jet going the other direction. We took off from Hawthorne, and we're going to Chino, cleared to Paradise, and then direct Chino. And so we were, same thing, kind of a similar angle, maybe a little bit further north even, approaching Paradise. And we were like 6 miles from the VOR when the turn anticipation started alerting. And I was in the left seat. I looked at the pilot in the right seat. We kind of scratched our head for just a moment and decided that the best thing to do was to fly to the VOR. And so we did, went heading mode, just flew to the VOR and made the turn. But there was, so it is a confusing kind of thing. And that was not part of an ODP. So it could be the rules are different. So I'll look at the controller guys again to see maybe whether that would have made a difference because it was not part of an ODP. We were just, you know, part of an kind of an in-route clearance.
So they just gave you direct Paradise clear for takeoff or direct Paradise release?
It was after from Hawthorne coming in from the west to Paradise and then left turn, we're going to be a left turn up to Chino.
So it was just a situation, almost like an en route, very steep turn. GPS is doing its GPS anticipation, and you're in a jet. So this is earlier, and your overshoot, you know, to turn around is going to be quite a bit further.
Like 200
but
knots.
You didn't get yelled at for doing it.
But we flew over the VOR.
But you flew over the VOR, right. sort of to that point. So, Mark,
it's funny. The first time that I ever heard about something like this. Was a pilot, and I forget which group it was in, but it was a pilot who told a story about anticipating the turnover of VOR in the Washington, D.C. area. So this is not only a West Coast kind of thing. It exists in other places that at some point ATC wants you to cross the VOR before continuing.
Bruce.
There's another point that... is sort of farther up in the setup of this situation, and it's the initial clearance, which includes these radial distance and radial-radial intersections, which are very common on these TEC routes.
Right.
Because they were designed before the GPS era, and FAA has not gotten around to replacing those radial intersection fixes with named fixes, which is what everybody wants. But that raises the point that depending on the equipment you're using and how you plan your flight, you need to understand, I see pilots all the time or posts on forums and things where they'll say, okay, now I want to try to build, you know, this user waypoint or something. Just use the green needles, you know, or at least a bearing pointer if you have one to help you anticipate that. And then make sure you understand how, for example, if you use ForeFlight, if you select that TEC route, what does it do? Because it translates that into something when it sends your flight plan to ATC. So, and then make sure that if you send the flight plan to your box using Bluetooth, that it is something that the box can understand. So it's just something you need to practice with and understand before you do it.
Right.
But
right.
Sometimes falling back to the old school is the easier solution than trying to reprogram the box on the fly, especially in this kind of short flight.
On what you just said there, the tech route in ForeFlight and what you're going to file is just the code for the tech route. But as you see kind of delving into this, on ForeFlight, it adds this extra waypoint because the actual tech route is just a radial to nowhere. Like just it used to say to intercept, I think it was the Hawthorne localizer and then, you know, turn in from there as part of the tech route, and which was incredibly confusing probably as well. And then they removed that. So now it's just this kind of open-ended thing. What are you supposed to do with that, you know, just in terms of programming the box? I mean, like you're sitting there nodding, Bruce, like how what would you have programmed into a box?
I would have understood that it was the 27, I think it's the 270 radial at 7 miles is the fix. That's what, that's what it's telling you in that funny looking code. And if you don't understand that, that's where you ask clearance or ground, hey, I don't understand this, clue me in. But then again, you could use, you know, again, a bearing pointer or the OBS and then... if you don't have DME and you can't put a fix in there, then maybe figure out is there a cross radial or something can help me identify where that point is or just query ATC. But in this kind of airspace, I want to make sure I'm clear before I launch. So if I don't understand, I'm going to talk to somebody before I get in the air to make sure that I'm doing the right thing.
So maybe even from the ground, when you had them on the 800 number from the phone, that I'm a little confused about this departure, just own up to it right there.
Exactly.
And what am I supposed to do in this situation? Sure, that makes lots of sense.
And they might come back with something, okay, you sound really confused. When you take off, fly this heading, maintain 3,000.
Which was 090 back to Houston or something.
And then when we get you all coordinated, we'll give you vectors back to where we want you to go. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's better than messing around in this airspace.
Well, in this, kind of stepping back a little bit here in terms of turn anticipation, is this something that we really need to think about beforehand? Or is there just enough, I don't know, sort of slop in the system, right, in terms of IFR procedures? That, yeah, even with a strong tailwind, the GPS tells you to turn early. It doesn't really matter that there's more protected airspace for ground-based NAVAID procedures on the opposite side than on the close-in side. I mean, is it something anybody really thinks about on a regular basis and thinks about how they have to deal with? Mark, you're kind of
probably not. I mean, I don't think people think about this at all until they, you know, come across it. And there's nothing wrong with it except when there is, you know, and if you're in a situation where ATC expects you to be crossing over and you don't, you're going to get that tongue lashing that the pilot got.
Kevin.
One of the things to think about with an obstacle departure procedure is they're designed to miss obstacles. They're not designed for ATC convenience. So ATC can assign them for their convenience, but I would expect that the fudge factors built in with NAVAIDs and turn radius and all that kind of stuff will keep you from hitting the ground, but may or may not help you out with missing what ATC is hoping you'll miss.
Bruce.
I was going to say, the other time I've seen issues with turn anticipation is not so much in a departure like this, but just if you've got, say, an approach loaded up, and either you've made a mistake or ATC changes the plan and you had a certain leg active and now you're, and all of a sudden they're now giving you this turn, it can be very confusing. And if you've got the box in nav mode, your autopilot in nav mode, it's now trying to turn before you really should turn. So this is, again, another case of where sometimes using heading mode or thinking heading is the best thing until you're really sure you've got things properly set up and that you and ATC are on the same page, because this happens fairly frequently. If you activate the wrong leg or go to the wrong fix, trying to be too far ahead of things sometimes.
Right. And what about, you know, using GPS to fly a VOR approach? Totally legitimate now, but now the tolerances are getting much tighter. You could have a VOR approach with a turn at the VOR, potentially strong wind. You know, is that something where you actually want to ignore the turn anticipation there? Because it's built into RNAV approaches. We know that the design of the approach, RNAV departures too, this is not an issue that somebody, you shouldn't try and forget about the turn anticipation on something that's built around RNAV, because that's baked into the design of the procedure. At least that's what our research has shown. But for ground-based procedures, they're still built around ground-based nav, and we can use a GPS to fly a VOR approach. You're nodding over there, Riz.
Well, let's not forget if it's a VOR-based approach, for example, your VOR can be off by 6 degrees and still be legal. And if the VOR hasn't been resurveyed and realigned, you know, and we've all seen the difference between like a GPS course and a VOR, you know, whatever the charted course is. That's fairly common because of the way they calculate variation and so forth. So at the types of airplanes most of us fly, at the speeds we're going, there's so much room around a nav aid. I'm not really worried about, it may make my approach a little less elegant. I might have to do a little chasing to get back on the course, but I'm not going to hit anything. So I wouldn't worry about it that in that respect.
Sure. I'm curious for both controllers here, how attentive do you think the controller would be to watching someone come off the airport and whether they're making a turn early on a procedure or not? Clearly, in the real world situation, the controller noticed for some reason the times it happened. But is that routine that you're like watching? Would that like throw a flag in someone's mind? Or is it just, yeah, the pilot's doing whatever they're doing? Kevin.
For me, if I was working this as a controller and I've got somebody that's going to be coming up on a nav aid to make some version of a sharp turn, probably. If I've got traffic that is going to be any sort of a conflict for this airplane, I'm going to put this airplane on a vector. I'm not going to bet on the come with whatever turn they're going to do. I'm going to assign a heading that's going to make it work and an altitude, and I'm not going to hope that they anticipate the turn the way that I think they should anticipate it.
Yeah, John. I mean, basically, exactly the same thing. It's a non-radar procedure designed to get the airplane off the airport and into radar contact. As soon as you're in radar contact, you know, a whole different set of rules take place. Now you only need 3 miles around them and a whole different set of rules. So the quicker you can get them into radar, the quicker you can get them vectored, the better you are. If you plot this out and if you use the old non-radar rules, it's an immense amount of airspace that has to be protected. There's you go back to the old non-radar school from Oak City, there's this thing called degree divergence. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, where there's actually a table so that the number of degrees between divergence between two courses, you know, it widens as it goes out from the fix. To get the 20 degrees of divergence that you'd need here, you got to be like 12 miles from the fix. And 12 miles from the fix is almost all the way out to a Dowd intersection. You know, so they would almost never be able to use real non-radar in this. You got to go to radar.
Well, and is that maybe a clue that this was all about traffic, that this procedure was assigned to you in an area where there's really not a ton of obstacles to worry about? The procedure doesn't take you super high, but that they assigned this, but there are a whole bunch of airports they don't want to shut down, and right. they need to get you turned before you can get into radar contact going a very specific direction.
Right, and the ODP calls for much, if you're going east and north, then you got to climb in a holding pattern to 4,100, I think it is, and then so. But if you're going westbound like this airplane is, it's 1,400 feet, I think, is the minimum crossing altitude. So the terrain is really not the issue here. It's more just getting you pointed in a direction away from other airplanes.
Right, and but it's almost like because it's two directional, like I need you going east and then I immediately need you going west before I can even get you into radar contact in this busy environment.
And well, only because that's the only place that the Paradise VOR was. And when this was developed, that was the only thing that they had to work with, you know? So if it was replaced by a GPS-based departure procedure, it would probably not look like this. It would be charted to go exactly where they need them to go.
Sure, that makes lots of sense. You know, I think there are a bunch of other things, if we pan out even further, that are interesting about the scenario. So I want to spend some time there. Let's look at the departure itself, right? So you're departing runway 25, and you make a right turn out because you have to fly the ODP it was assigned to you. But you're departing the airport in VMC, and it's left traffic for that runway. What do people think about this right turn turning out? It's by the book, it's correct. But in terms of playing well with other aircraft, is it still something you'd worry about? Or is anyone going to notice? Kevin?
I think traffic permitting, and given the way that this turn is obviously going to shake out, if I could, I would be making a right turn to join that course from the airport to the nav aid prior to that point where I have to start the left turn, if I could, if traffic allowed. Mm-hmm.
If you were thinking ahead enough, though, a left turn to the left downwind actually would have set you up better to intercept that course, because remember when we actually flew this in the sim, like it was as you're rolling the wings level, you're 5 seconds left before the turn anticipation. Right. A left turn might have helped out. If you had thought about that, would you have said, yeah, a left turn? I might have done a left turn.
I wouldn't have, but the only reason I say that is because ATC specifically assigned the ODP. So I want to fly it.
Right. So you have to fly it to the left.
As much as I can.
And it's I'm sorry, I'm jumping in.
No, that's go ahead, okay. John.
So it's Class G airspace here, you know, so 700 below, have at it.
Yeah, so there you go. But to the point, you're still flying the procedure to the letter would right. be a right turn against the traffic flow.
Yeah, but that traffic flow goes out the window when you have a specific instruction to make the right turn.
Yep.
You're not going to be popular with the people in the pattern, but hey,
Right, exactly. Mark?
Well, there's nothing from a regulatory stance that's wrong with that right turn, because the traffic pattern rule is when arriving. It's not when departing. But I have a standard issue, is that when it's VFR, then you have to play nice with the VFR traffic. No ifs, ands, or buts. So I would still make the right turn, but at the same time, I might not make that right turn at 400 feet. I may wait till 1,000 feet, till I'm at or above pattern altitude before making that turn, which, interestingly enough, would give us more room before reaching Paradise VOR.
But would that actually, by the time you turned and checked in with the controller, get you scolded because I assigned that ODP so you would turn sooner, right? So if you kept going westbound rather than turning at 400 feet, and the whole idea was turning you westbound to get you over Paradise and then turning you, you could get chastised for flying straight out for the farther than you had to.
Mark. I will accept that scolding.
Okay.
I will gladly accept it. So,
John?
Yeah, I got something directly on that. So what's interesting is this is a Class G airport, you know, to the surface. If it was Class E to the surface, when issuing the departure instructions, the controller is required to ask the pilot if this will comply with local traffic.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Because it's controlled airspace to the surface. Okay? You can't ask somebody about what they're going to do in uncontrolled airspace by definition, because you have no control over it.
Yeah, but that's fascinating that I can't even ask you about your decision and what you might be doing.
It's up
just
to the
because
pilot.
I don't get to say anything about it.
It's up
it.
To the pilot. You can do whatever you want. You could fly IFR in Class G.
Right, but I can't even ask you about what's going on there. Is sort of
well,
what
you can
saying.
Ask what runway. Everybody asks what runway they're departing, which is probably what they did in this case to assign the 2-5 departure procedure. But the point is that if it was Class E to the surface, you're required to solicit that information from the pilot.
Kevin.
Reference Mark's comment about maybe delaying the starting the turn. I definitely have been that controller who has ripped pilots a new one on the frequency for delaying that turn, because there's at times can be traffic conflicts where, say, you're departing on an airport that's got a runway 11, for example, and you're told on the Class Delta airport, turn right heading 250, runway 11 clear for takeoff. You're expected to start that right turn. And then when you don't, there's a ILS going on to a big busy airport that's nearby that is loaded with airplanes on that final that now you're in conflict with.
Mark.
If we're talking Class Delta,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And I've gotten that also. We want you to start that turn now.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, I expect that in Class Delta because there aren't any traffic conflicts. I'm not worried about VFR traffic in the pattern.
Sure.
I'm simply following an ATC instruction from the ground.
You know, we're talking a lot about trying to, you know, slot yourself into what's going on and thinking ahead and how things might impact, you know, what the controller wants, what you're doing. I'm going to pan back even further on this flight, in that this is, you know, today's flight is a short one, it says right in the intro. It is a busy one, too. And I could easily see this pilot, before takeoff, they've loaded the approach for where they're going, and wisely so, and that's the first time potentially they're going to be in instrument condition. It's not a very difficult approach, but it's going to come up quick, right? Have they gotten sort of too far ahead, and that's part of what happened here, was they're really focused, you know, on the job interview and the next approach potentially, and not really thinking about, like, how they might be getting out of this airport. Tom?
Yeah, well, I would say good luck to this TB-21 pilot in finding Hawthorne in this kind of weather. It is a very difficult airport to pick out. That I just was talking about that flight to Chino, actually, a couple of days before I'd flown into Hawthorne, turned inside of Paradise to the Powell Up intersection, and then came, you know, straight into Hawthorne, and it was very difficult to find. And I was talking to pilots on the field there who were based there, and they're like, oh yeah, even those of us who are based here struggle to find it, and particularly at night with all the lights and stuff around, it's like it's really tough. So
or late afternoon with the sun in your face.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And yeah. So you're right, Jeff, about the idea that Being prepared for a short flight is often a lot more work than being prepared for a long flight.
Bruce.
And I'll get on my soapbox one more time and say, you know, again, we talk about approaches all the time, but departure procedures are something that a lot of pilots either aren't never really learned properly because, you know, even at Boeing Field where I fly, we have RNAV departure procedures, but they're essentially, they want you on runway heading, radar contact, vectors, right? And a lot of instrument pilots just don't practice and understand how demanding an IFR departure can be, even in VMC, with things like these tight turns and the congested airspace. You really have to prepare for those as much as an approach. And often they're more demanding in a complex airplane because things are happening so much faster than on a nice, steady approach.
And how might you use the technology at your disposal, Bruce, to prepare for this? Because when you read it, it's not obvious that there's a tight turn or that there's going to be a problem or how fast things came up. You know, that's why I was being honest about, yeah, this would have really surprised me because I would have pictured it in my head. And yeah, okay, it's over there. I'm going to turn around. Ah, I'm already there. How would you prepare it using the tools that you have?
Here's what I do. I have the Garmin free PC trainer suite on my laptop and my home computer. And if I see a situation like this, I'm unfamiliar, I load that up and it doesn't have a flight model. It's not a full flight simulator, but I can practice loading it up in my GTN and then seeing how things happen. Oh, and then I would have noticed, wow, there's this steep turn. How am I going to handle that? How might I set up bearing pointers, whatever? So simulation, whether it's an iPad simulation or this Windows-based trainer I've just mentioned or fly it in, you know, especially if you're unfamiliar, it can be really helpful.
And you're a big advocate, too, of marking up charts.
Absolutely.
On your iPad. Is this a... you know, a situation where that would have been useful potentially?
Yeah. For example, on both departures and approaches, even if it's an RNAV procedure, I put green boxes around the nav aid frequencies to remind me I should have something tuned in, preferably with a bearing pointer if I have that or a second CDI. Oh, that's a reminder. Maybe I can use that somehow. So that's the sort of thing I like to do.
Panning back even further here about how busy this flight is and what we've heard about this pilot, you know, went from private pilot training, oh, that got boring, hey, that looks like a sports car, I'm going to buy it, checked out in the airplane, instrument rating, you know, because it was required by insurance, and now hoping to impress the people at SpaceX by flying his airplane in for his, you know, job interview. I feel like there's something that could be said about dangerous attitudes here and who this pilot is and maybe setting oneself up. You were smiling and nodding over there, Elaine. Would you speak to that for a moment here? Because I don't want to leave without addressing it because I think it really plays here.
Sure. That's the mentality that is probably akin to a get-there-itis where you're just focused on the end point. It's a means to an end. And obviously this pilot skipped details, like not anticipating that sharp turn was coming up and not anticipating that, oh, I may have to do something a little different here, maybe something I hadn't done before and possibly not have reviewed it or practiced it ahead of time, because I think the pilot seemed very focused on, yes, I want to land here for the job interview and in my plane, and seemed a little bit more focused on that. And that can be as bad as get-there-itis just in and of itself. It can cause you to miss things, and it can cause you to possibly push yourself further than you would normally go or what other people would normally do. I would agree.
Well, now I'm going to play devil's advocate here a little bit, because some of the folks, actually it's literally the people on my left side of me, are nodding, and the people on the right side, particularly you, Mark, are giving kind of a maybe not sort of look to this, because the truth is we want to use our airplanes for things. We want people who are motivated. This pilot was, you know, did the research, was well-rested, put everything in advance, and truth be told, showing up in an airplane for an interview with an aerospace company actually might really count in your favor. That's pretty cool. You know, might and put you in the right mindset if it goes well. So counter this, perhaps, maybe?
I'm not sure if it's counter, but I think one of the things that stood out to me reading the scenario was that we have a pilot who goes, what are these tech route things, and where does this go after here? And he kind of picks a fix because he gets a recommendation for it. You know, if he actually did brief the approach into Hawthorne, Surprise, the initial approach fix for that is 7.8 miles on the 271 degree radial from Paradise VOR. So I think this really is, other than perhaps expecting that sharp turn, this is not difficult. You can have everything loaded up before you ever leave the ground.
You know, that's a great point, that IFR is a lot more than just flying in the weather or dealing with the deconfliction with other traffic when you can't see each other through ATC or even the airspace and control. From the ATC perspective, I feel like it also relies on a predictable behavior of the airplanes. And the controllers are nodding here, and that's reassuring to see. One of the takeaways from this is that always accurate, stunningly precise WASP GPS of yours has no clue about doing what ATC expects. You know, and until we get some AI that sort of can play both pilot and controller mind, thinking ahead in order to be predictable, that's on us as the pilots.